Okay, so we're going to do something a little bit different now, a little bit of risk-taking of our own, perhaps, and give you a taste of the kinds of insights that a risk scenario analysis can produce. And we're going to do that by actually doing a live risk scenario analysis. We've assembled a panel of experts here, a kind of fantasy risk committee, if you like, who will be doing the scenario analysis, and we're going to discuss the impact and the implications of three different risk scenarios that we chose out of quite a long list of possible risks that one might want to look at. Before we do that, I'm just going to go through a little bit of background as to why scenario analysis is important. Now, obviously, we've heard a lot this morning already about the different techniques that different companies use to try and bring out the risk appetite of a firm and understand how capable they are at actually managing risk. And this is just one of those techniques. I guess it's similar to the risk-a-thon that we heard about earlier. And in particular, this idea of risk wargaming, so rather than the sporting metaphor, we're going for the military metaphor, how that can be used to enrich scenario analysis, to go beyond the what could happen to look at how would we react and how good would our reactions be. Now, I'm going to whiz through this a little bit quicker because we're running a bit short of time, but you'll have to take my word. It was a fantastic, entertaining short presentation, laughter, tears, the whole lot. So, financial services is complicated. And if you have a look up on the screen, I've got two very complicated pictures, which I don't expect you to be able to read, let alone interpret, other than just to accept that financial services is complicated. On the left-hand side, we've got the anatomy of the GFC, a kind of recipe for financial crises. And really, the GFC started back in the late 90s with the various Asian financial crises. It took about 8 years or so to bubble along and brew through excess liquidity coming out of Asia into North America, combined with low interest rates, led to a big excess of credit, which led to a property bubble. Bang, property bubble bursts, and we are where we are now. On the right-hand side is it's a fantastic little risk interconnection map that the World Economic Forum has put together. It kind of looks like a, if you're from the UK, a Geordie's view of the important cities of the UK. But if you actually have a look at this map, it's fantastic interactive little thing. You can click on any of these risks, and it pops up with all of the different other types of risks that this would be connected to, and the importance and the potential impact and the probability of such a risk occurring. So we've drawn from this selection of risks for our three scenarios. Very quickly, one of the reasons for actually doing this kind of exercise, if you look at the survivors of the GFC, those who did well versus those who did not so well, shall we say. There's a bunch of common themes that come out of the way that they run their business. Strategy and communication, knowing what's going on, knowing what different parts of the business are doing, making sure as much as possible that they're all coordinated and pulling in the same direction. Expertise and internal processes, making sure that there's a healthy skepticism and challenge within the business, that you don't just have the risk takers running off and taking risks without a second line of defense of some form, stepping back and saying, well, hang on a minute, are we sure that we want to be doing that? Firm-wide controls and analysis. It's absolutely true that you can't measure anything, and it's also true that any kind of risk-based steering framework has its limitations. So there has to be a strong control framework sitting underneath the broader risk-return trade-off systems. And risk measurement itself. What we've seen is that the companies that did well actually were able to measure the risks, and were able to measure them in fairly good time and to the right degree of sophistication. So there was a general understanding of the risks that were being taken. So if you want to get to that kind of capability, if you want to be one of the winners rather than the losers, the kinds of questions that you as risk managers should be asking within the business are as follows. Have you been able to react to changing market conditions as and when you wanted to? So it's important to know where the blockages are in the business. not just to report on risks, but to understand how good the capabilities are to react to risks. Can you identify and examine likely or stress scenarios? And furthermore, can you deal with them? So identifying the scenarios is one thing. Actually articulating what you would do in case one of these scenarios happened is equally as important. It's the kind of thing that we'll cover in the scenario analysis. Do you receive all the information that you require in order to manage the risks and to understand the potential weak spots in your business? And then finally, coming back to this response capability, does management have a clear idea of what they would do in the times of crisis and market dislocations? And particularly important if you actually want to take advantage of opportunities. So we always hear about making sure that we understand risk return as well as downside risk. So actually understand what the opportunities are coming out of a market dislocation and being able to react faster than your competitors puts you in a fantastic position. So if we just look at risk wargaming itself as a concept, it's really a kind of two or three step process taking basic scenario analysis a little bit further. The first step, of course, is the scenario identification. And it's important here that you don't just come up with the same old set of scenarios. It's important to draw from the expertise right throughout the business, not just the senior executives and the risk team, but actually drill down into the guys who are sitting on the floor, bored with their jobs, dreaming up ways of destroying the business in their spare time. Yeah, those are the people that actually understand some of the things that could really go wrong in your business, probably much better than the senior executives do. So make sure you draw from all of that expertise. And then understand what the potential financial, operational, and business implications of those risk scenarios are. If you're actually doing this kind of exercise, it's important to come armed with some good facts and figures, as well as a good description of the scenario. The wargaming itself actually takes place over two stages. The first one is the discussion of the scenarios. Get all the relevant people in the room and talk about the impact of the scenarios, what you would do, and so on and so forth. Coming out of that, the next step is actually to go back to the business and say, well, if this event happened, senior management have said they would want to do this. Can we do it? And it's really important to ask that question and almost to run some of those things through. One of the biggest problems that a lot of the banks faced during the financial crisis was not identifying that there was an issue with Bear Stearns or Lehman's, but it was actually understanding what their exposure was sufficiently quickly to be able to act on it before the rest of the market tanked. So really dig deep into your response capabilities, not just understanding the first order impacts. So the second workshop then that you would do in a risk wargaming sense would be the debrief. Report back to senior management and say, here are the things that we could do. Here are the things that we might be able to if we actually focus our efforts and investments. And here are the things that you asked us to do. And frankly, it would take us 3-5 years to actually build the capabilities to do that. And having done that, of course, it's important, step three, to actually put in a plan of action and implement the plan of action. Make sure that in a year's time, you're able to do things that you weren't able to do coming out of this first war game. So with that as some background, let's go into our live risk scenario analysis. So as I said, we've got our panel of experts. It's kind of like QX Factor. Sorry, that was really bad, wasn't it? Okay. Forget it. Okay, so we've got three people up here. We've got Tony Coleman. I'm sure many of you know Tony. He's a corporate advisor and a company director and a former president of the Institute of Actuaries. He was chief risk officer and group actuary of IAG for many years and prior to that a corporate advisory partner of PwC. So Tony has many, many years' experience as a CRO and as a chief actuary in the insurance industry. Our second character on our fantasy risk committee is Rob Daly. Rob's the chief actuary at Tower Australia, so brings an interesting life insurance perspective to what we're doing here, as well as, I think, an interesting counter to a CRO's perspective in terms of a chief actuary is much more involved in the, I guess, first line of defence activities as well as the second line of defence activities. Rob's got extensive and potentially expensive experience in risk management from his time at Tower, but also previously at Tillinghast. And he also practices dynamic risk management in his spare time with the occasional mountain biking and snowboarding. And then our third panel member is Andrew Hinchliffe. Andrew is a managing director and head of structured sales within fixed income, currency and commodities at Goldman Sachs. Andrew's been involved in helping insurance companies and other financial institutions manage their risk for many years since joining Goldman Sachs back in 2001. So we've got a great array of expertise and experience up here with our panel. Now, we've looked at three different risk scenarios to try and come at a quite a diverse different range of issues that an insurance company might face. If you like, we can characterise these by a measure of plausibility as well as a measure of the scope of the implications that each scenario might have. So the first one is a global double-dip recession, one that actually hits Australia as well this time. The second one is a terrorist attack on a Sydney financial complex. And the third one is a longer-term scenario around extreme weather patterns and climate change. The kinds of things that we'll discuss with the panel are up there as follows, and these are the kinds of things that you would want to make sure that you covered in any kind of scenario analysis or war gaming. So what are the immediate financial and business consequences? What are the broader implications that could have a second-order impact on your business? How would you respond to such a scenario? What kind of reporting and information would you need? How would you like to steer your business prior to something like this happening? So what things should you be doing now in order to minimise the impact? After the event, what would you do? What would your response be? And how would you actually discuss it with the market as well? It's very important to get the communication externally correct as well. And of course, as I've mentioned before, what capabilities would you need in order to execute the response that you've come up with? So, our first scenario, and now I'm going to join the sofa here. I'm going to chat show mode. So our first scenario is a global double-dip recession, and you can see the details up on the screen. So we've got drastically lower than historic global growth, so less than 2% per annum GDP growth. In particular, China's growth slows to less than 6% per annum. G20 debt to GDP increases dramatically. This time Australia doesn't escape. Low GDP growth, high unemployment, low interest rates, and house price stagnation. At the same time, we see the chaos return to the global capital markets. Substantially increased equity market volatility, another blowout in credit spreads and the risk of significant credit defaults, and a significant global monetary impact as a consequence. So, sounds pretty nasty. We're going to start with Andrew. Andrew, Goldman's, I think, quite rightly have a reputation as being one of the best risk managers within the financial services industry, and that reputation was enhanced through the global financial crisis. This must be the kind of scenario that you look at quite regularly within Goldman's.
Yeah, thanks, Anthony. It is. I suppose just to characterise Goldman Sachs, one of the things that's been mentioned through the presentations this morning is it needs to be a culture of risk management. The first realisation that Goldman needs to take risk to make returns, as mentioned by Craig Dunn, we agree with that wholeheartedly. Secondly, it needs to be embedded within the culture about managing that risk and understanding exactly what it actually is. You know, we are historically a partnership and we mark to market our balance sheet, and that background has led us to have very strong risk management controls. We have all of the normal daily reporting in terms of VAR and jump to default and credit spread widening and sovereign risk that will feed up to the CFO. But more recently, we've started to undertake some of this risk wargaming that we're talking about here today. And very recently, this was one of the scenarios that was dreamt up by our chief risk officer and asked all of our independent risk functions and business units to put through the paces. the way the process works within Goulburn is to chief risk officer dreams up the scenario, which is very, very similar to this. He works closely with the macroeconomic research department to parameterise that scenario. So what are the assumptions that we should be making with respect to inflation, employment and GDP growth? They then work very closely with the risk function of the business units to put that into context with respect to market variables. So what happens to credit spreads? What happens to equity markets? What happens to equity volatility? What happens to commodity prices, FX markets around the world? And all of that is thought through with respect to an overlay, and those overlays being what happens to the franchise. You know, in that scenario, business is generally slower, it's more competitive, revenues come under a whole lot of pressure. How do we react with respect to compensation? Is compensation lower across the board? What is monetary policy response, fiscal policy response, regulatory policy response? You know, what is happening to the banking sector? So putting all of those overlays on top of the financial variable calculations that are going on, we'd run that scenario over time and feed into a variety of different functions, being market risk, credit risk, our treasury with respect to liquidity and capital and balance sheet, and ongoing revenue. And you know, ultimately, we look at what consequences that has for probably three key metrics, P&L, capital and liquidity. And this particular scenario, I'm not allowed to divulge exactly what the results were, but you know, you can rest assured it's not good. And I would say most of us are in the same sort of position. And you know, while I can't say what the results were, you can get a little bit of an insight into the way our balance sheet has changed, both pre-crisis to where it is today. You know, as of early 2007, we were about $1.2 trillion of assets. Liquidity, which we were absolutely paranoid about, we had about $60 billion of what we call global core excess, which is cash and cash equivalents on the balance sheet, which represents a negative drag, and we had about $40 billion of equity. Now, if you look at our balance sheet today, our balance sheet is down to about $840 billion. Our capital's gone from $40 billion up to $70 billion, and our global core excess is now gone from $60 billion up to $170 billion. So that's a significant change in the balance sheet. Some of it's regulatory-driven. Some of it is purely as a result of what is our outlook on the world going forward. How do you survive in the world going forward? And survival is a big part of any risk management.
Okay. Tony, you mentioned when we discussed this scenario a few interesting, maybe not so obvious impacts that something like this might have for general insurance companies, the exchange rate in particular.
Yeah, obviously one can also look at the first order effects on the balance sheet of a general insurer, but the sort of things that also start to tend to happen, which you probably don't think about first time round, is the parts prices for repairing cars, if you're a general insurer, are quite heavily influenced by the exchange rate. So you can have some quite unexpected effects in your cost of repairing cars pop through very quickly. The other one that also impacts in a situation like this is the sales obviously get harder, but it's doubly hard because quite often you find that there's a material impact on the value of used cars and therefore the sum insured for used cars, which means, of course, the premiums are dropping because the sale prices of the used cars are dropping. Obviously somewhat difficult to control, but it does impact your revenues. So there are some effects like that that start running through the system, which, if you don't think about it, can actually impact your ongoing profitability quite quickly.
Okay. Rob, on the life insurance side, presumably the balance sheet impact would be the first place that you would look in a scenario like this?
That's correct. And for most life insurers, the balance sheet impact is probably manageable within our capital, and it's the first thing we'd look at. The second element is very much the medium-term growth perspective. What we found during the last crisis is there does seem to be an uptick in sales when the economy goes down, and we think that's because it increases people's sense of financial insecurity. And one way to mitigate your financial insecurity is to buy life insurance. So we suspect we'd get a similar effect for short term. The issue we have, particularly with a prolonged downturn, is affordability, which is many consumers may just struggle to afford insurance premiums and may, after an initial sort of fear reaction, may start increasing their lapse rates, new sales numbers might drop, and that would be a concern for us, how that would actually play out over maybe a 3 to 4 year period. And the two issues around these sort of scenarios that get us very concerned is the two extreme outcomes that can become more possible in such a scenario, and those are really for us inflation or deflation. Now, for a life company, inflation initially probably is negative on our balance sheet. Our view is over time is probably a positive because our revenue, our premiums are inflation linked. So our premiums will almost go up automatically as inflation increases. There's a negative pullback on that because of affordability, as mentioned earlier, but the first order go forward effect can be positive. In many ways, deflation is more of a concern because it's shrinking growth. In practical terms, a lot of our expenses are wage related, and practically it's hard to cut wages in a deflationary environment. Interestingly, that has happened overseas, which is quite unusual, but that is another one of our fears. So when such a downturn occurs to us, we'll immediately start trying to modify our business to handle it through our normal budgeting cycle. But we will get more concerned about those sort of twin fears of inflation and deflation.
Andrew, are these the kinds of scenarios that a company like Goldman's would write protection to an insurance company? So would you actually be the counterparty to hedges around interest rate risk and so on, and therefore yourselves carry some of the burden of this?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is essentially where my business focuses on, is to think of these scenarios on behalf of clients and then try and come up with solutions that are manageable in the capital markets that help hedge those particular scenarios. And the point that Rob makes is a good one and certainly one for discussion at the moment is clients and Goldman, for that matter, are stuck between do we move into an inflationary environment or do we move into a deflationary environment? And which one do I manage to? Which one do I actually try and hedge? And it's a difficult question. And where we see a lot of clients come out at the moment is, well, what are the actual consequences associated with each? What's my loss given inflation? What's my loss given deflation? And the vast majority of pension funds, for example, globally, view the deflation scenario as the big risk, not surprisingly. And you know, they're an example of some of the types of transactions that they would look at is long-dated interest rate swaps to hedge interest rates coming down, various you know, puts on asset classes, whether it be commodities, whether it be equities, whether it be certain growth currencies. More recently, transactions are being done in the inflation market where large pension funds and asset managers are buying floors on US inflation and stripping out the embedded optionality that's within the US inflation-linked bond market. These are all various instruments that are available to clients, but the more pertinent thing is they understand the instruments are out there, but it's more around quantifying what is the bigger risk for that particular client and for ourselves on balance sheet, and then managing to that risk and ensuring survivability under that particular scenario.
Okay. A question has just come through around how you look at liquidity and in particular making sure that you've got the cash in the right place given restrictions around moving money around between different businesses that particularly come up during a financial crisis where individual country regulators are more concerned about the viability of their own markets?
No, that's a good question. I mean, if I had to characterise the two biggest risks to Goldman that we've always thought about, it's liquidity risk and reputational risk. They're the two hardest things to manage and the two things that will drag the firm down. And, you know, that's been probably our two biggest challenges over the last 3 years. No surprises there. More recently, we've had to think about liquidity risk a little bit differently. I mentioned the metric earlier on where our global core excess, and that's the cash balance on balance sheet, went from about $60 billion to, after the crisis, up to about $170 billion, which is a significant drag on balance sheet. That's how important we actually think it is. And you know, I suppose just going back to pre-crisis, given we were paranoid about it then with that $60 billion, what we did back then was pre-fund a lot of our liabilities, and we termed out that liability structure. And even then, during that crisis, it was barely enough. More recently, we are changing the way we think about it. We have a treasury function, which is ultimately responsible for raising liquidity out in the capital markets and, you know, maintaining an unsecured credit curve. But they've more recently outsourced some of that liquidity to a group internally, which is cross-jurisdiction and cross-business units, to independently price that liquidity and make the business units more accountable for liquidity. So rather than centralising it, make the business units pay for it at that point of time of usage. They take that into a calculation in any of their business decisions around return on equity, return on capital, return on liquidity kind of metrics.
Okay. Tony, one of the areas of conventional wisdom, I guess, is that claims increase during a recession, particularly on general insurance, but also, I guess, to some extent, life insurance claims as well. Given that we haven't seen a significant recession in Australia for many, many years, how well is that actually understood within general insurance here in Australia?
Probably the first thing to say is that it's generally not quite as simple as that. There is perhaps a tendency for more fraudulent claims, and it's possibly the case that workers' compensation business, I guess, in particular, might be more subject to that risk where there's more unemployment around. Having said that, it doesn't always work that easily in that way, so it's not sort of a case of night follows day. But once again, in the context of risk management, obviously it's something you need to be thinking about. The tricky bit there, of course, particularly for workers' compensation schemes, is it's not necessarily something that you can easily mitigate, even if you've thought about it. There's not a lot really you can do about managing that risk unless you want to seriously think about shedding the underwriting of the risk that you've got in the first place, but that's a fairly extreme sort of reaction to take if you're sitting in a general insurance market that you've built up for many years. So it's more a case of thinking about it perhaps in your ability to ride through the downturn in profitability that's likely to arise from that.
Okay. And is that something that you would pick up in if you do an economic capital calculation, which tends to be fairly statistical based? Would you do that kind of scenario of different risks coming together with a higher correlation as an adjunct to an economic capital calculation?
Oh, I think different insurers approach it different ways, but certainly it would be amongst the relatively normal range of stress tests or scenarios that you'd think about in thinking about the outcomes that could eventuate. Yeah, and certainly it's the sort of thing that would be built into a typical dynamic financial analysis sort of exercise as well, generally, yes.
Okay. Rob, what about on the life side?
Similar to Tony's comments in workers' comp, we would expect disability income claim costs to go up. We generally find the impact is seen in the termination rates. So people, this is a general statement, but people generally new claim rates don't go up that significantly. But it's harder for people to come off claim, because to come off claim, you need to be both well and generally to have a job available, because there's a very large grey area about how well you actually are. And what we find is claims tend to last a bit longer because people move in that grey area. Now, we would try to mitigate that by stronger claims control. Unlike a lot of workers' comp situation, we can have a direct influence in claims control. So we would look at that through the period. But we'd expect an upward push on claim rates as a consequence.
Okay.
With trauma, you don't tend to get it. You don't tend to get it with death either, although there's been some indications that the suicide rate went up in North America and Europe through the last crisis, but only very broad indications.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But it's not so significant in those areas.
Okay. What about the reserving of long-tailed liabilities? The fact that we don't, in Australia, have a very active or deep longer bond market. If we've got long-tailed liabilities, it means you're having to reinvest every few years. This kind of scenario, which could last certainly the low interest rate element of this could last many, many years. Is that a factor that I guess each of you would take into account in one way or another?
That is probably by far the ugliest scenario of all, particularly material changes in real rates of interest, not so much necessarily nominal, but for a long tail book, that kind of scenario is pretty ugly. And indeed, you've seen that sort of scenario beginning to unfold with one of the major global insurers operating out of Australia, in their last published financial statements. So, but equally, the way those books are structured, it's a difficult one to avoid, if I can put it that way. And the financial impact can be quite severe, generally probably much more severe, I would suggest, than some of the other things we've talked about for a general insurer in this sort of scenario.
It's a particular issue if your regulatory discount rate is based on the bond market, because you tend to see, in a deflationary environment, obviously interest rates will fall, but in a place where certain companies are under financial distress, they will drop out of riskier positions and go into the bond position. So you'll actually see the bond rates will fall more than the equivalent swap rates. So you tend to get a double whammy on the way down during the crisis.
Okay, and presumably that will be baked in under the new regulatory capital regime as it's currently being discussed.
Looking at an APRA representative. all I'll say is we live in hope.
Yeah, sorry, that was the lobbying bit for the day. Andrew, presumably you're a man with a solution for this.
Yeah.
Or is this something that it impacts everybody, and therefore it's not a case of, there are ways of actually transferring that risk to a better balance sheet?
There are definitely mechanisms to transfer that long-dated interest rate risk to the capital markets. There's no doubt that increased size of long-dated bonds would be most welcome by the market, and is important. I think it's important for clients also to understand what risk they're managing to. If you're managing to regulatory capital risk or accounting risk, a lot of clients, for example, may use just a 10-year government bond rate and extrapolate out due to the lack of a presence of anything longer dated. Now, that's clearly not going to show up in capital or P&L calculations, the curve risk that we're actually talking about. That said, if I were to think about my pure economic risk, then clearly I am carrying a lot of economic risk, which is the reinvestment risk that you're actually talking about. And there is a long-dated swap market that does exist that is relevant and usable. There are funds out there that are willing to provide that liquidity and risk into the insurers that actually need it. I'm not saying it's the most liquid market. It could improve, but it's an important thing to think about.
Okay. So let's move on to our second scenario. And you see that we've placed this in the much lower probability, and we certainly hope this has a very low probability of occurring. But the impact of this kind of scenario could be massive. It's the kind of thing that may actually fall outside of many economic or regulatory capital calculations. So it is something that we think is worth looking at on a standalone basis. Also, the operational implications of something like this happening. So the scenario is that there's a terrorist incident, a bomb in a high-rise office complex in the Sydney CBD. We assume the buildings are completely destroyed and a significant number of the occupants die. Just to make this a little bit more tangible, let's assume that within this office complex there's a Big Four bank, as well as an emerging foreign bank, and also two major financial services-focused professional services and consulting firms. Now, those of you who know Sydney might have a sense of what we're talking about here. So the direct losses would be significant, somewhere up to something like 5,000 losses lives lost. Life insurance claims well over $1 billion. Property and liability insurance claims getting upwards of $10 billion and a significant impact on business revenue. So, Rob, I think the way to think about this scenario is probably to look at different timescales over which the reaction occurs. What would happen on day one? You know, when as an insurance company, you first hear the news of something like this?
Yeah, thanks, Anthony. This one is quite personal because I was in New York on 9/11, and I was also in London during two of the very large IRA car bombs of the late early 90s. Of course, I was brought up in Dublin, so I saw a lot of terrorist activity for many years. And I just want to contrast in terms of the day one impact between what I observed in New York and what I observed in London. The Commercial Union bombing happened in an evening. The scale of damage was immense. It pretty much blew out every single window of the CU building, which, if you know what that building was, is in the heart of the City of London, complete glass-fronted building. So huge damage. It would have damaged the Lloyds building a lot worse, but just the way the explosion went, it didn't impact Lloyds too deeply. And the offices we were in were just down the road from there, relatively unscathed. I believe in that bombing, no one actually died, because it was late at night. It was actually very fortuitous. And the impact the following day, for myself personally, but for many of the businesses, was we were sent out by someone. I worked at Munich Re at the time. We were sent out to take photographs of the site so we could send it back to board members in Germany. But that was the extent of the impact. Otherwise, it was very much business as usual. The contrast was something like what Anthony has described and what happened around the World Trade Center was the loss of the timing of the event. It happened about 9:15 to 9:30 in the morning. The loss of life makes a real big difference. And the key aspects of that from the immediate planning, it has a huge emotional impact on every company in the area. And the reality, if you're trying to war game this, the primary concern, if we pick Tower as an example, because our offices are in Milsons Point, so we might observe the disaster, but we wouldn't be part of it. The primary thing that will happen is everyone in the building will be worried about people they know who are in the city, they'll be worried about family, and they'll be worried about getting home. And that is what will probably happen on the first day, frankly. You won't do much in the way the recovery planning you were hoping to do, because the priority will be the personal priority, making sure people know what's going on, they have support, and so on and so forth. And just, I guess, realise that in the wargaming, that it'll be very hard to identify the people who will actually move to the system critical functions on day one, because their minds will be elsewhere. But after that, for a life insurance company, our priorities will be the people working in the building, that they can get home safely, and by and large, that we can start to function the following day. What happened in New York is that pretty much the city was closed down the following day. So you'd have to plan for people not being able to get to work. So there'd be a lack of commuting. The other aspect of the World Trade is it took out a transport hub, which meant, and it would be the same if this happened in Sydney. So train stations wouldn't be working in the CBD. You couldn't rely on getting much more than a skeleton workforce into your company the next day. And so you have to have adequately testing, you know, remote facilities, which are pretty much a given. But it's not just that. You need to have some way of communicating between senior people. You need to effectively know how you're going to operate without people being in the head office. But the other thing that will be very important for a life company at that point is actually dealing with our policyholders' concerns, because we will have policyholders who will have been impacted. We'll need to get the call centres back up and staffed, and we'll need people who can deal with policyholders who will be quite traumatically impacted. So it won't be just a question of paying claims, it'll be a question of almost counselling and dealing with the trauma that people will be going through. And I'm sure we'll have people ringing us up who don't have a policy with Tower, but don't know who they have a policy with and will want that information. And being staffed and available for that will be a real struggle. So I think if you're planning for these disasters, just remember the emotional aspect. Remember, people won't be behaving as you expect them to behave, and they won't be that concerned about your company. They'll have other concerns. But pretty quickly, you need to, despite all of that emotional background, you need to be pretty quickly getting your business back together again and getting out there to do what you're there to do, which is to look after your customers and make sure we can provide the benefits to them. Mm-hmm. So those would be the priorities.
Okay. Tony, what about from the general insurance side?
Some of the concerns would be similar, but I suspect actually could wind up being more extreme in terms of financial impact. But once again, and this is a situation that IAG did explicitly war game several years ago, and I think in fact did it twice over a few years. One of the big problems that we identified was, for those of you aware of where the US consulate is, if a bomb goes off in the US consulate, it will probably blow out most of the side of the IG building glass. It will probably take out a fair bit of APRA and quite a few other buildings around town as well. And, of course, that's a fairly high priority target in a terrorist situation. The other scenario to contemplate is if the bomb happened to go off in the stock exchange, it isn't going to help your asset market for a while. Issues that do come up in surviving the first 24 hours really boil down to, how many staff have you got left? Where are they? Are they in any sort of mental condition to work at all? And can you communicate with them at all? Because you probably have to assume that you've lost all your mobile phones in Sydney, because that's a fairly highly likely scenario. You wouldn't have mobile phone communication, and a lot of the landlines would probably be gone as well. So you have to start planning for how do I manage in that scenario. And there are all sorts of things you can think about, but obviously you can assume it's not going to be easy. To give you some sort of a insight, we actually had operational plans not only for that scenario but a sort of related one where we sort of tried to think through what's the worst case scenario that we could ever have to deal with, and that of course is an earthquake in Sydney, a major earthquake in Sydney, and we assumed that we would lose all our buildings in Sydney operationally permanently, and at the same time of course have to pay a hell of a lot of claims to policyholders. And we've tried to figure out how would we survive that scenario. And, of course, the answer is we had a capability to switch systems, both IT and telephone systems, so that when calls came in, they could be serviced Auckland, Brisbane, Melbourne, Adelaide, Perth, with staff who were still there, even though we'd lost most of Sydney, in essence. And, of course, the same thing happens with normal workloads being managed, but you had to actually have the capacity to assume that was going to happen to you. That capacity, of course, became very handy in managing this sort of event as well if it got really ugly. So those are the sort of things that we certainly thought very explicitly about, and I'm sure many other financial services institutions do as well. Certainly in Sydney, I'm aware that there's been quite a lot of public sector planning around this over the last few years as well. Some of you will have noticed that there are now loudspeakers up on many corners of Sydney that actually allow the population to hear emergency broadcasts from the authorities, because obviously at times like this it won't be necessarily what you tell your staff to do. It may very well be what the police tell your staff to do that matters. And so you have to... I think our organisational capacity within Sydney to deal with a crisis like this is a lot better than it probably was 3 or 4 years ago because of some of those steps. So there's a few thoughts around some of those sort of scenarios anyway. But I agree with what Rob said. I mean, you can safely assume the trains won't be running as well. So if any of your staff have survived, they will be facing a long walk home probably.
Now, after day one, I guess you start to rely not on your own business continuity, but on that of all of your counterparts. So reinsurers, the payment system, if we're talking about a major bank being involved in this, that might have an impact on the payment system as well. What do you think would happen to the financial markets and the ability for, money to flow around the system after something like this?
There's no doubt be a significant dislocation. I mean, our initial response is similar to what the guys already mentioned, and that's with respect, we'd set up an incident response team which would focus primarily on people's safety and things like that at the outset. But then, very quickly it turns to what is the overall effect on counterparties, clients, Goulburn's balance sheet, and there we're looking to, for example, currency probably drops anywhere from 5% to 25%. We saw during the crisis when that actually happened that imposed a lot of liquidity issues on, for example, the superannuation sector and corporate sector, which does a lot of offshore hedging. So our counterparty risk to those particular entities would go up, and it's something we'd look at very quickly. Likewise, to the extent that settlements all of a sudden became an issue with some of the big banks, to the extent they're involved, then we'd look to potential counterparty risk and settlement risk associated with that, either primarily from those particular banks or secondarily from clients who are depending on payments from those banks. There'd clearly be a significant move with respect to interest rates, front-end interest rates, and the requirement to provide liquidity to clients around that. There's a lot of funds that would look to try and hedge themselves after such an event. And globally, we'd think about what is the effect on commodity prices as well and growth implications to the extent Australia is a significant input into that. And I suppose the other effect there is contagion effects as well. What other countries look a lot like Australia that could also be subject to terrorist attacks, given that they're then topical again? And so we take a pretty holistic view of it.
Okay. Reinsurance would obviously become very important at some point after this event, and for both the life and the general insurance sector. How would an insurance company typically be covered for this kind of event? Tony, do you want to?
I think it's probably the case that for property damage, if it's domestic houses or cars you're talking about, certainly some companies have taken the view that they'll just carry the risk themselves because it's not an easy one to reinsure, on the understanding essentially that it's pretty hard, if you're a large company anyway, to see an event where the terrorist event is likely to be sufficiently localised so that you can actually withstand that given the size of your overall portfolios, i.e. if a jumbo crashes, it's probably only going to take out one or two suburbs of Sydney, not the whole of Sydney. Conversely, if it's commercial property, then of course we rely on the Australian Terrorism Insurance Pool. I think I've forgotten its proper name, but there is a specifically structured entity which is ultimately government-backed and which I don't think has yet ever had to pay a claim, but it's definitely there and it has a suitable reinsurance structure effectively built around it, and you can safely assume that would certainly be, be claimed upon by the major reinsurers. In that event, the major insurers. The other thing that's probably worth just mentioning from a business continuity point of view, an event like that, and certainly something that we gave some thought to, if you're in a situation where your backup major IT centre might be provided by, shall we say, a major computer services provider, sometimes known as Big Blue or other, think about where you might be in the pecking order if there are two or three other major financial institutions also using the same provider for backup services. We came to the conclusion that we thought maybe this was not necessarily a great idea to be in a situation where we knew that there were two or three other majors that had the same backup provider, and so we actually opted in the end to have a completely independent backup that was owned. Was our own one, if I can put it that way, that we knew where it was and we'd be the only one using it. And, of course, it's nowhere near Sydney. So that's another issue that I think could well become an issue if two or three major financial institutions suddenly found themselves trying to use the same backup centre.
And, Rob, on the life side, what would be the process of actually getting in contact with your reinsurer and kind of starting things moving there? Because I guess you have a pretty significant liquidity risk unless you can actually access the reinsurance.
Yeah, I think that's correct. In terms of, we'd be protecting two layers of reinsurance. We'd have catastrophe cover, so we'd have to get in touch with that program and start arranging for some payment from it. We would also have to get in touch with our direct reinsurers because they would still be exposed to quota and surplus arrangements. And again, those are primarily Australian, so that should be hopefully relatively straightforward. Mm. One, the nature of this event, if it's Australian local, the reinsurance is pretty much supported offshore. So I do not think we'd have a concern about the counterparty risk on the reinsurance, because generally this would diversify against their global portfolios. Mm-hmm. But actually a range that we have the cash coming in before we have to pay the claim would be very important. The other point on payment system, I think it'd be reasonable to assume that the payment system would probably survive something like this. There's very good disaster recovery plans. The system itself is diversified across the different institutions. However, I suspect dealing with policy discontinuance over the following few months will be difficult, because people will probably ensure that main payments will happen, but when something happens to a policy and we don't get a premium payment, it'll probably prove a lot longer to get that problem fixed and to actually receive the payment from the policyholder again. So I think we'll have to look at issues such as sort of delays and increased delinquency and delays in premium payment will probably come through over time.
Okay. Just a reminder that you can SMS in some questions to the panel. The number's 0414-079-448. Bit of an advertorial there. One question that did come in, which I think is actually really quite relevant, is how the RBA itself and the other government organisations would get involved in helping manage the market disruption. Andrew, what's your sense on that one?
I'm not exactly sure the way the mechanism would work. I would imagine the RBA would be very responsive. I mean, we saw exactly what the Fed did straight after 9/11, and I was over there for that. And you would say they did everything they needed to do to provide liquidity to the system at that point in time, and I'd suspect the RBA will do exactly the same thing. It certainly worked. I think the problem there is that they left the liquidity in place for a little bit too long. And, we got to where we got to in 2007. But the response was quick, and it was there was a strong fiscal response. I would imagine the RBA would not need any co-opting, and there are others in the room that probably know a lot more about that than I do that may suggest otherwise, but I'd hope the response would be pretty immediate.
Okay. And longer term, there are going to be some impacts on emerging claims over the next few years. Rob, I think you were thinking in particular trauma insurance.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of impacts. The two unexpected things, well, probably one shouldn't have been, but that came out of the World Trade, was the claims that occurred among the people who were cleaning up the site, because they'd gone in to clean up very quickly. They were exposed to a lot of toxins, and there were a lot of claims as a consequence, as one perhaps unanticipated consequence. Another thing which will hit disability income, to the extent people suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder, that will tend to result in disability income claims, which will have an immediate impact. Well, not immediate, it'll probably be a 3, 4, 5 year impact to our portfolios.
Right.
The other aspect, and it's hard to talk about the good side of these events, but the reality is we probably will have an increase in the desire to buy insurance coverage, particularly life and disability income coverage. Mm-hmm. So we'll probably see an increase in sales as a consequence.
Okay. Presumably reputations are at stake as well throughout all of this, and your ability as an insurance company to pay claims, be responsive, be sensitive and so on is actually going to be critically important. Do any of you have any thoughts on that one?
No, I think you're correct. The brand is so important, and because people have the insurance for this very need, so you need to be able to show that you're providing it at that point.
Yeah, that's absolutely the case. And you'll find insurers would generally, they often have crises that they have to deal with, which in many cases are weather related. Obviously, we've had cyclones, we've had bushfires. They stress the organisations, but because they do it every 1 or 2 years, it seems these days, they get a bit of practice at it and actually do have processes in place that allow them to start paying claims really very quickly and get people on the ground, even in quite difficult situations, to allow that to happen.
Okay. Speaking of weather-related claims that seem to be happening more frequently, that's a great segue into the third scenario, which hopefully we can get up on the on the screen, which is a much longer term but potentially much more systemic risk scenario, which is extreme weather patterns emerging from global climate change. Now, Tony, this is obviously something that's very close to your heart, so why don't you kick off? We've put a scenario up here which talks about rising temperatures, prolonged droughts within Australia, increased intensity of bushfires, problems with fresh water supply. Probably one of the biggest longer-term issues is rising sea levels.
Yeah, well, this is one that one could talk about for quite some time, but I think you need to subdivide it into what you might call the slow-burning issues, the ones that just gradually creep up on you, and clearly, I think increased weather-related events, particularly as they're impacting on the pricing of house insurance now, as you will see, you know, typically in the market, house insurance pricing has persistently been going up for the last few years at greater than the rate of inflation. And the reason it's not impacting motor insurance quite so much is that obviously house insurance has a larger proportion of the total risk premium driven by CAT events, and therefore it is more subject to that risk. Obviously from a risk mitigation point of view, you just keep putting the premiums up and kind of hopefully that fixes that problem, although of course it makes affordability of the cover more of an issue. At the other extreme, you've got the more directly related events like obviously the bushfires in Victoria, which were a pretty catastrophic event from all sorts of points of view, fairly obviously. But if you want to go to the other extreme, we can obviously start talking about, and I'm not sure if we've got the slide there, but contemplate what effectively would be the Australian equivalent of Hurricane Katrina. Now, this is a scenario that's been modelled by most, I think, of the major players who'd be affected, both direct insurers and reinsurers. I think it's fair to say that certainly all the climate change information tells us that the probability of this kind of event occurring is gradually rising compared to the status quo of no climate change. The scenarios generally come out at something between insured property damage, between $15 and $20 billion, which will pretty much stress at the upper end just about all the direct insurers' CAT programs for reinsurance. And the scale of that sort of event, though, needs to be thought a little bit about. The first thing to bear in mind is that you're talking about a cyclone that travels sort of down the coast across the top of, say, Sunshine Coast, Brisbane and the Gold Coast. And just think about the Gold Coast for a minute. It's basically roughly 1 metre above sea level. You know, some of it's half a metre above sea level. And we're talking about a major centre of population just in all those canal developments. Most people don't understand this, but a typical cyclone, of course, is fundamentally a low-pressure system. And when it sits over the sea, to simply balance out the pressures, the sea rises under the cyclone, and generally that's about 2 metres. Just, this has nothing to do with the wind, that's just normal pressure. On top of that, you'll get wind waves driven by the wind from the cyclone, at least 3 to 5 metres on top of that. So you're talking about something that will dump a very large amount of water from sea level rise, before we worry about the rain system coming out of the cyclone, that might be somewhere in the vicinity of 2 to 5 metres higher, going over ground that's only 1 metre above sea level. That's going to have a pretty serious impact on a lot of people, in particularly the Gold Coast. But the Brisbane River's not a great look either. So you're talking quite a lot of fatalities and casualties, obviously. And then, of course, there's significant property damage, as I mentioned earlier. If you don't think it can happen, on that slide there, there are tracks of two other cyclones from 1967, I think, and 1974 from memory, which actually did go pretty close to that. So it is definitely a scenario that could happen. The other thing that's a bit of a worry about it is that all the building codes north of Rockhampton in Queensland, of course, assume cyclones are going to hit them sooner or later and the buildings are built stronger to begin with. South of Rockhampton, that ain't the case. And, of course, this is all south of Rockhampton. So the building damage will be severe because they're not cyclone standard built. So let's hope it never happens, but that's the sort of probably the extreme end scenario. When you start talking about a scenario like that, of course, you're talking about extreme damage to infrastructure as well, You assume when you're going in there as an insurer afterwards that if you're going to pay any claims, you won't have mobile phones to be able to rely on. Your systems will probably be shot, so you need satellite phones. Once again, most of the major insurers have all sorts of processes in place to be able to, largely built on previous cyclone experience, particularly Cyclone Larry, where they actually have processes in place for trying to cope with that. But it's not easy, obviously, and it's not going to be easy for anybody if it does happen. And you only have to look at New Orleans now. I've forgotten the figures, but I think only the population of New Orleans even today is only 60% of what it was before Hurricane Katrina hit.
Okay. Without wanting to pick too much on the reinsurers, the global reinsurance capacity is going to be a major issue. If we're talking about global climate change and in particular rising sea levels, even as a life insurer, presumably, even though you may not have a first order exposure to something like this, presumably rising sea levels putting pressure on the reinsurers, that you're going to have a second or third order exposure, both on the liability and on the asset side, presumably.
Yeah, I think you're correct, because the exposure of global losses eventually might reduce in a rating reduction for the reinsurers. It probably depends on the capital market cycle, because if any individual reinsurer can recapitalize through the cycle and then charge the increased premium rates and recover the losses, the impact won't be a counterparty impact, but we will still see the impact through premium rates. But I think whenever a big disaster like this happens, we'll have to look at our counterparty exposures to the reinsurers and try to take action where we're overexposed to a particular reinsurer to manage through any credit issues.
Actually, I think the rising sea level scenario is not so much really an insurance industry problem. It's a banking industry problem and maybe a wider society industry problem. When you think about it, the value of waterfront properties that are likely to be permanently inundated is predominantly the value of the land. And, of course, insurers don't insure the value of the land at all. Sure, they're going to lose the buildings, but actually that's the small beer in the scheme of things. The loss of value to the actual landowner and presumably the bank who has often got a mortgage is actually where the real damage will be, and of course it won't be insured. Yeah. I do know that at least one of the big four major banks has seriously started to focus on this very issue, and you will probably have a lot of difficulty getting a loan from that particular big four bank now if you do have a property which is exposed, because they've actually started to identify in relatively great detail which ones they think are exposed. But it is an issue, obviously, in places around Sydney, for example. I mean, I hope none of you live too close to Narrabeen Lakes, for example. If you do, I suggest you think seriously about your risk management strategy. I mean, obviously, this will tend to happen. There'll be a big storm and, suddenly some buildings that used to be there simply won't be there anymore. It will happen suddenly, but it will be caused by persistent and increasing sea level rise. So there's a few of the issues. One of the other things I forgot to mention earlier, when you were talking about the reinsurance, as many of you in the room would be aware, extreme weather-related events are not just the really big ones. We've had a hailstorm in Perth, I think it was about a year ago now, which, up until then, it didn't hail in Perth. There were a lot of reinsurers running around with furrowed brows talking about unmodelled risk. So I'm sure they'll come back with higher premiums next year. But those are the other sorts of things that start happening in this sort of scenario.
Okay. Andrew, the capital markets implications of this must be pretty significant, are they?
I think so. Just a quick point on the reinsurers. I mean, while Goldman doesn't have huge exposure to the reinsurers, I mean, that is certainly a risk that we would identify as being extremely important, and we'd try and manage very, very carefully. Anywhere where there's large concentrations of counterparty risk, we manage very, very carefully through either very timely collateral mechanisms or buying protection, on whether it be equity or CDS protection. And that would be certainly one of the things that I'd be focusing on if I were in the insurance industry in Australia, to the extent that you are reliant upon a few key reinsurers to underwrite your risk. And perhaps that is all being done, but that's where Goldman would certainly focus. And a case in point was AIG, well-documented case in point. And you can read all the various transcripts, but they're essentially a reinsurer to Goulburn for Financial as well as other counterparties. And, you know, it was all around collateral and managing that counterparty risk. The implications of this particular scenario, I would say it's a... And Tony knows a lot more about it than I do, but I would say it's a very slow burn. It's nothing catastrophic apart from the actual cyclone itself, but in terms of the rising sea patterns, rising sea levels, there's nothing catastrophic about the rising sea levels. And as he rightly points out, it probably is more of a banking sector problem with respect to property and you know, loans against that property. And we would probably look more to counterparty risk associated with the banks, collateralisation associated with those banks, and you know, overall health of the banking industry in Australia in general.
Given the sort of slow development nature of this kind of scenario, it's the kind of thing that's going to play out over a number of years, although maybe fewer years than a lot of people would like to believe. Do any of you see any business opportunities or you know, kind of upside from this in terms of the insurance business?
It'd be the type of thing that would certainly, you know, to the extent there was decent risk margin and premium. We do have a reinsurance group, for example, offshore now, or an insurance group. That's the type of thing that Goulburn would look at and say, all right, return on equity, return on capital is likely to increase in this particular field as a result of increasing premiums due to concerns around this. Is it worthwhile us you know, getting into the insurance business to actually provide that? It's not necessarily going to be the case, but that's the way we'd try and think about it. And you know, business units would be encouraged to think about opportunities like that. And the firm generally embraces that kind of type of entrepreneurial culture. As I said, it is a risk-taking culture, and if you can prove that the risks are well managed and well understood and well thought through, then no one's stopping you from actually going out and trying to monetise that.
Yeah, there's probably a few comments I should make about that. First of all, there are some multitude of general business opportunities driven by what I'll loosely call climate change, potential emission trading, et cetera, which are not really in insurance specifically, but they're certainly in financial services more broadly. So, yeah, that's, yeah, some of the business opportunities are very large. From a more direct insurance point of view, certainly it's possible to, indeed, one or two insurers have done, make investments in equities of businesses that they believe will do well as a result of climate change. Which is a slightly more general pattern, but you know, I think it was fairly well known that IG invested in Generation Investment Management, which is the company that Al Gore and David Blunt run, and even after selling down a lot of the equities in the portfolio several years ago, retained that one because we believed it would be an outperformer, and it has been quite substantially. So, I mean, that's one potential opportunity directly resulting from climate change. The other thought that has been looked at by, I know, a number of general insurers both in Australia and overseas, but hasn't really been able to be implemented because we couldn't see quite how to make it work, was clearly you can think about who is going to do well out of a major event like a big cyclone, bushfires, etc., or an earthquake. And obviously the answer is the people who build things or supply building materials. And so you can contemplate a scenario where can we develop a natural hedge in our investment portfolio where if we are overweight in those things, it'll help offset, you know, the disaster that comes on the other side because the value of the shares in all of those companies will go up. The problem is that it's pretty hard to identify, you know, for each particular catastrophe, which particular companies will be the big winners. The very fact that I'm telling you about it tells you that at least some insurers did seriously think about it as a risk mitigation natural hedge strategy. I don't think anyone's actually managed to make it work, though, but obviously they're the people who do win in those sort of scenarios. You know, people who make concrete, steel, bricks, roofing tiles, building contractors, people who rebuild things like railways and airports, etc.
I guess one of the challenges with this scenario, and something that we've discussed previously, and it's also been raised in a question, is we've kind of got the boiling a frog issue here, particularly with these slow burn scenarios. How do you actually know once you're in it, and know when to actually take action on this, so you can identify that there is a risk sometime in the next 10 years that something might happen? Do you actually jump in now and spend the money, invest in the protection today, and risk essentially wasting that money if things don't actually pan out?
I think it's I'm just thinking through that issue as well, which is how do you deal with these very slow moving events? And I'm not sure what impact would it have on life insurance claim rates. Like I've heard people discuss increased prevalence of tropical diseases, for example, but I suspect even if that occurred, it'd be a very slow occurrence. We'd probably adjust for it through our premium rates. So I suspect we can do it through normal mechanisms and allow for it. The other issue with these events is any one company, even a company as large as Goldman Sachs, probably can prevent global warming. So there's a limit to what you can actually do to the root causes of the event. I think you have to take those as a given. And then there's a question about whether you can modify your business model in some way to be better situated. But they're just harder events to conceptualize, because from a social economic perspective, they'll be very large events. But how they'll actually impact specific industries is harder to see. A general comment is flexibility is important. So the Australian life insurance industry is better placed because we renew our premium rates on a regular basis. So we're flexible enough to deal with these sort of changes. If we were offering 30-year level premium guaranteed rates, we might have more of an issue. But we do have some advantages in how our industry is structured.
I think the most effective mechanism, certainly for Goldman, with respect to monitoring these slow burn risks, is the fact that we mark to market our balance sheet. And the Australian insurance industry does that, banking industry doesn't. But essentially what happens is you mark to market your balance sheet, that shows through your P&L immediately. And you can see very quickly, how things are gradually evolving. These feed into your various risk metrics that feed up to the CFO, and that feeds essentially back down through the controls, the risk controllers, to the business heads, where we can control the levers about whether you're taking too much risk, too little risk. And it was something that Goldman used pre-crisis. We saw some of the asset-backed securities and RMBS securities behaving relatively poorly from a P&L perspective through observable marks in the market. And that led to some of the decisions around trying to de-risk with respect to that particular asset class, and more generally trying to prepare the balance sheet for more difficult times. So we'd say the mark-to-market of balance sheet, it works for us, and is something that we use as essentially the canary in the coal mine to try and identify changing trends.
I guess one issue that probably comes through in all of these scenarios is the problem of systemic risks, and the fact that a lot of these things are not just affecting an individual business, but they're affecting either the entire industry, in the case of climate change, potentially the global financial system. Do you think that there's more role for industry bodies or other government agencies and so on to provide a backstop for these kinds of things? I guess longevity risk is another one which is often talked about in terms of the government is the underwriter of last resort. Now, we've got the terrorism reinsurance body, which was set up by the government. Do you think there are other things that industry bodies and so on could do to help, either in terms of rapid response capabilities in a short, sharp scenario, or broader sort of systemic management capabilities? Or is it everyone for themselves?
Yeah, that's a really difficult question to answer.
It's all right. We've
clearly
only got 2 minutes.
If you get a coordinated view that everyone agrees with within a given industry group, so that you've got a united view on it, then you're in pretty good shape to go and lobby government and get something done. And that in some cases, if you pick a narrowly defined enough part of the problem, you might actually be able to achieve that. I think the problem with climate change in particular has been that it affects a lot of different people in a lot of different ways, point number one. Point number two, there's still clearly an element out there that I'm not even sure that it really is happening, if I can put it that way, despite considerable scientific evidence to the contrary. So you get a very muddied picture, and you don't necessarily get everybody speaking with one voice, and therefore you don't. It is a very tortuous, complex process to try to get a position that everybody that like to be affected will agree with. So I think that's one of the reasons why climate change has been and will continue to be a difficult problem to manage.
Okay. One last question and then we'll wrap up. And I think it's an interesting one, again, from the context of climate change and managing these slow burn risks, is changing your policy conditions over time as and when risks start to emerge. How effective are things like exclusions as a risk control mechanism, given that they always come under, you know, the extreme test when an incident happens, and there's a lot of pressure on the insurer to waive the exclusions in times of disaster and so on. Should you rely on the ability to actually carry through on policy exclusions?
That can be very powerful, and of course the best time to make sure they're in there is before the events happen. And to make it very clear, I do recall a few years ago now one particular situation that arose in the industry in Australia where people were looking at what could happen, you know, if avian flu really took off. And there were certainly some business continuity policies out there which were quite common, where effectively they provide, because of their wording, fairly good cover against avian flu. And the consequences for the industry as a whole were pretty catastrophic had that event happened with those covers in place. So there was actually a move, which the industry did all agree on eventually, although it wasn't easy to get a unified view, that, you know, the industry broadly, you know, one of the two other major players started it, but everyone eventually followed, that, you know, exclusions were put in place to change the wording so that actually avian flu would not be covered if, in essence, if in those wordings, you know, when the policies were being renewed on their annual cycle, because actually had that not been changed, that, you know, that we would have had a number of bankrupt insurers around. So that was one example, I think, where actually it was quite effective. You are right, though, there is often enormous political pressure, particularly in the past in flood insurance issues, from politicians to pay claims where, you know, the policies don't actually cover them. Yeah.
I think from a life insurance perspective, we are reluctant users of exclusions because the marketing message we provide our customers is we'll provide you a benefit if you die, and we're not going to try to get out of it on side issues. So for a life insurer to say we'll provide you a benefit if you die except if it's avian flu would be pretty much unacceptable from a marketing perspective. And that's the dilemma you have with exclusions, is they're obviously cost-effective because they take out a whole class of potential payout. But if you're trying to provide a sort of a universal coverage, they take away from the core need you're providing. Like a customer who has a need for life insurance also has a need if they die from avian flu. So useful to a small extent, but I think they damage your marketing proposition and your customer proposition.
Okay. Well, I think we'll wrap up here now. It's time for lunch, so just ask you all to thank our panellists in the usual way. And of course, after all of that that jolly discussion, we've got the ultimate risk mitigant for our panel, which is a bottle of wine each. Thanks very much.
Thank you.